You and I, we sweat, babe. Bodies all aching and racked with pain. Take that barge, lift that bale, get a little drunk, and you land in jail. I get weary and sick of trying. I'm tired of living, but scared of dying. But old man River, he just keeps rolling along. Then the plants are soon forgotten. We just make our way through another day with an aching body. Just confessing our lack, our total lack of faith and practice before Old Man River. It's not about eliminating the pile of stinking waste products, but just appreciating that tiny shining jewel in the center of it, which isn't the slightest bit diminished by it. And our appreciation might even take the form of what looks like non-appreciation. I don't see any jewel in here. That's a bunch of Zen hogwash. Right there, the jewel. So today we celebrate our great beneficent original teacher Shakyamuni Buddha's great enlightenment, the most wonderful day for the Buddha's followers. But interestingly, in the Zen tradition, instead of making offerings to the radiant, bright, chosen one with multicolored halo and radiant light beams emanating infinitely to every quarter, we make offerings to this image on the altar of the ragged, worn down, tired Shakyamuni Buddha. This is the image in Japanese Zen that's hung on the altar for Rohatsu. It's, you know, a very ordinary looking guy, kind of ragged and a little bit unkempt. Not so radiant as most of the images of the Buddha. And they say it's The painting's called Shakyamuni Descending the Mountain. So he went up to the mountain peak and realized the way, and then we celebrate his coming down. We celebrate his descent back into the world of Santa Cruz, where he will go and look for something good to eat and maybe take a bath and see how he can be of help in this confusing world. I think it's beautiful. And I don't know the story of why that came to be, that ragged image of the Buddha is the one on the, we could say, most important Buddhist holy day of Buddha's enlightenment, is the image that's celebrated. Maybe because at the end of Sesshin, we might feel a little bit like that. Maybe at the beginning of Sesshin, we feel like that. How are you all doing?
Pretty ragged.
This is a long Sesshin. And we're still here, some of us. And it's beautiful to wholeheartedly engage the way like this. Yes.
It's nice to be on this train with Kodo Sawaki because I could feel a little less sorry for myself before.
Yeah. His extreme practice puts it all in perspective. And also his great struggle in his early life, if we remember back to the early days of Sesshin, losing both his parents at early age, getting shot through his neck with the bullet coming out his mouth, and as soon as he recovered, being sent back to the battlefield, his parents going crazy, he had a rough early life, and I think that fueled his practice.
Gave him strength,
yeah, yeah.
The trials of life.
Yep, the trials of life. So, Sesshin can be like, I think, gives us strength that you could say, just to sit here, be willing to like sit in a body aching and racked with pain, builds character. And say, well, what about the Buddha's great enlightenment? Well, I think there's multiple, infinite layers of benefit to Sesshin. And then as I say that, I remember Kodo Sawaki, who would whack me with a stick if he heard me say that. There's no purpose of Zazen, there's no benefits here. You're not going to get anything out of it, and if you try to promote it in the smallest positive way, you defile it. Just do it. And do it endlessly with no getting nothing from it. is the supreme aspiration. So difficult.
That's the attitude when you sit, not expect any reward.
Yeah.
But there are benefits do come.
Maybe.
I mean, the benefits start at the physiological level of rest the body gets. There's benefits there.
Of course. I think we probably wouldn't have lasted this long if we didn't see any. But Kodo Suwaki is very skillful, I think, at, like, you know, if we start to get into that mind as to encourage ourselves, then he's saying that's a little extra. It's okay. It's not so bad, really. But I found a, what is it? In one of these pages here, something from Tenshin Roshi, my teacher, where he said, to sit for any reason is not really sitting. To encourage ourselves to practice is an expression of doubt that this is it already. I mean, this is kind of like Kodo Suwaki, a little bit strict teaching, right? To encourage ourselves to practice is an expression of doubt. I think, you know, we might say, sometimes, well, we need to go through this or we'll just give it up. But on a, you know, on a deeper level, oh, come on, let's do it, is kind of like missing the fact that it's right here already, perfectly complete. To push ourselves with the gaining idea is off track. Just return to the present, moment by moment, and let go. Nothing else necessary. I might have been part of the same conversation. I remember somebody asked him, like, do you... I think it was actually about this... somebody was asking, it was in Sashin, about this night sitting, right? There's a tradition at Tassajara of people go back to the Zendo and sit at night. And somebody asked, do you recommend this night sitting? And he said, no, I don't recommend it, actually. But I actually don't even recommend Zazen. I don't recommend Tenshin Roshi, Reb. I don't even recommend Zazen, not to mention, like, extra Zazen. Because, you know, that's a little bit like encouraging. A recommendation is a little bit like encouraging somebody to do something that they're not already doing.
That seemed to be the same way, admitting our total lack of faith.
You know, yeah.
It's kind of, I don't know if to say I have faith, but I mean, I come, you know, if I was at Tassajara or a monastery, the bell would ring, I would kind of know where to go, you know. At home, it's a little different. Maybe, I don't know, we got a schedule, so we can, but admitting our total lack of faith, I don't know how to live that. Seems like I have faith.
We definitely all have, I would say, a huge amount of faith that we're willing to sit in this room, especially for more than one period of Zazen, not to mention Sesshin. I think Dogen's saying, you know, we doubts arise still, right? We still don't, our faith is not complete. It sounds like Dogen's faith was not even complete because he said, I vow to hear the true Dharma, and then upon hearing it, may no doubt arise in me, and may I not lack in faith. So we could hear that maybe as Dogen even saying, I have these doubts still about this, and but I vow to, the more I hear the Dharma, the less the doubts will push me around. The more the doubts can just be like little clouds passing through the sky. But if we kind of bypass the confession part and say like, yeah, I have no doubt, I have total trust, this is it, then we may be like, something's eating away underneath us. If we say, no, I actually do have some doubt. I have some doubt. And my ability to practice, I think I mentioned at the beginning some, I remember somebody, I guess Sashin in the past saying, a senior practitioner saying, Sashin is making mincemeat out of me. So we might all have that experience at one point or another, meaning like, I thought my practice was pretty together until like, you know, the fifth or sixth day of Sashin, and now I'm like totally falling apart. It's a mess. At least sometimes we might feel that way. I think it's wonderful. I think that's what Dogen's talking about is doubt that, is it possible to really drop off body and mind in a moment-to-moment way? But we keep going. We keep wholehearted engagement in the way. Yes?
Shohaku said that one of his sashins, after it was over, one of his no toys sashins, but even their schedule, which is not quite Sawaki Roshi, goes from 5 to 9. He said it's designed so that nobody can do it.
Yeah, it's like a forced surrender. I often think of Sashin that way. You know, I also used to like doing sweat lodges, Little Bear, Esalen, tribal medicine man, right, who lives on Tasahar Road.
It's that.
Yep. So he would offer sweat lodges to Tasahara people and everybody, and so some of us would go there. I would think of sweat lodge at the time as like, oh, this is like a 3-hour sesshin. It's like a whole week sesshin packed into 3 hours, and the main way it's similar, I feel like, is that forced surrender, like. There's no way I'm going to survive this. I am like quite convinced that I'm going to die here.
Yeah, people are crawling out. Yeah.
Yeah, you try to like don't escape.
I'm
you know.
Die.
Yeah, you know you can put your face right into the dirt, and there's this little like half inch layer where it's like a quarter degree cooler at the very bottom, and if your nose is right in the dirt. It's like, it's a slight relief, which is a nice symbolic thing too, right? Put your nose, rub your nose into the dirt, and it's a little bit easier. But, and you know, it's good for like stubborn people like me, like, well, we're committed to not leaving, so I guess I'll just have to die. I'm gonna die. I hope, you know, I have a nice funeral. Because I don't think we'll get through this one. And then it's, you know, it's symbolic of the Esalen style sweat lodge is underground lodge. It's, I think in all Native American traditions, it's meant to be like the womb. You're going into the earth mother womb. But there they actually build it underground, so it's like you're really in the womb of the earth. And then you emerge at the end, and it's like being born onto the earth again, and emerging from Sashin can sometimes feel that way. Even if it feels like, well, it wasn't so good, I didn't do so well this Sashin, I was sort of floundering around a lot, still we come out and it's fresher, it's a fresh life, and it's despite ourselves, the Sashin does it. And what is the sashin that does it? Us. All of us. You know, we all create that for each other. All floundering around together, right? And then we all emerge fresh. It's very strange. Miraculous, even. Amazing. So we Rumi has a poem that I found next to this other one about, you know, we want to go all the way and drop off body and mind, be Buddha completely, but we just make our effort and whatever we can is perfect. So Rumi says, just because you can't drink all that falls doesn't mean you give up taking sips of rainwater. If the nut of the mystery can't be held, at least let me touch the shell. Just because you can't drink all that falls doesn't mean you give up taking sips, little sips of rainwater. If the nut of the mystery can't be held, at least let me touch the shell. So I think Sasheen often feels that way. And we may have to celebrate Buddha's enlightenment with some words about that today. So I was looking at, you know, the sutras, the Pali Canon, the old version, and the Mahayana sutras get even more exalted description of the Buddha's enlightenment. I thought this is nice version, this Zen version by Keizan, our Soto ancestor. The transmission of light record begins with Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment. And because it's not quite, the exalted ones are really great. I like feel happy reading them because it's so awesome. And we celebrate that later today when we chant for the Buddha and we strew white mandarava flowers over Buddha and the great assembly, and we blessings rain down from the heavens. And so there's that, and then there's just the kind of more simple Zen version. Shakyamuni Buddha saw the morning star and was awakened and said, I and the great earth and all beings simultaneously achieve the way. Keizan says, Shakyamuni Buddha was of the sun race in India. At the age of 19, or usually we would say 29, he leaped over the palace walls in the dead of night, and at Mount Dantaloka he cut off his hair. Subsequently, he practiced austerities for 6 years. Later, he sat on the adamantine seat, where spiders spun webs in his eyebrows and magpies built a nest on top of his head. I don't think that's in the Pali Canon, but he sat so still for so long that spider webs started forming in his eyebrows and birds' nests formed on his still body. Reeds grew up between his legs as he sat tranquilly and upright without movement for 6 years. At the age of 30, or usually you would say 35, on the 8th day of the 12th month, Rohatsu, as the morning star appeared, he was suddenly awakened. These words, I and the great earth and all beings simultaneously realize the way, are his very first lion's roar. From that time on, for 49 years, he did not spend a day alone, but taught the Dharma for the assembly constantly. He was never without a robe and begging bowl. During that time, he taught the assembly more than 360 times. Actually, it's like thousands of times in the sutras. Later, he transmitted the treasury of the true Dharma eye to Mahakashyapa, and it's been passed down from Mahakashyapa through generation after generation to the present. Truly, it's been transmitted through India, China, and Japan, and America, where the practice of the true Dharma is based on it. The practices of the Buddha's lifetime are the standard for his descendants. Even though he possessed the 32 marks and 80 minor marks, these are, in the sutras, the Buddha's marks, like, Dharma wheels on his hands and things. He certainly looked like an ordinary old monk and was no different from other people. Therefore, after his appearance in the world, those who emulate his teaching and conduct model themselves on his deportment, use what he used, and each moment while walking about, standing, sitting, or lying down, do as the Buddha did. Buddha after Buddha and ancestor after ancestor have simply transmitted this so that the true Dharma is not extinguished. It is, again, amazing to me that someone who lived 2,500 years ago, we still do, in our small, humble, simple little way, try to practice the Buddha's way, right? We sit like the Buddha sat. We sit like the Buddha sat. We sit like the Buddha sat. And we celebrate his life. And we gather as a sangha, like in the Buddha's sangha. We wear the Buddha's robe, eat in the Buddha's bowls, and practice Buddha's way. Somehow his way is like still alive in a distant land and time. The blessings of the Buddha are inconceivable that is even possible. So in the story, I and the great earth and all beings simultaneously achieve the way. We've been studying this I this week, yeah. So Kazan says, the so-called I in this story is not Shakyamuni Buddha. And Shakyamuni Buddha comes from this I. This now, I think we're talking about the big I. I, not my little illusory self, attain the way with all beings, but big self. This I is not Shakyamuni Buddha, but Shakyamuni Buddha comes from this I. Not only does Shakyamuni come from it, but the great earth and all beings also come from it. Just as when a large net is taken up, all the many openings of the net are also taken up. When Shakyamuni Buddha was awakened, the great earth and all beings were also awakened. Not just the great earth and beings, but all Buddhas of the past, present, and future were also awakened. Since this is so, do not think it was just Shakyamuni Buddha who was awakened. You must not see any Shakyamuni Buddha apart from the great earth and all beings. Even though mountains, rivers, and their myriad forms flourish in great abundance, none are left out of Gotama's eye pupil. Now, this eye, the Buddha's eyeball, is the great earth and all beings. All of you here are also established in Gotama's eye pupil. Not only are you established in it, but rather it is enfolded within you. Buddha's eyeball is folded into our very body and mind experience every moment. Also, Gotama's eye pupil becomes this flesh body. It becomes the whole body of each person standing like an 80,000 foot precipice inside each of us. Therefore, do not think that from the past to the present there was a bright eye pupil and myriad people distinct from that. You are Gotama's eyeball. Gotama is the entirety of each of you. If this is the way it is, what do you call this principle of enlightenment? Let me ask you, does Gotama become enlightened with you, or do you become enlightened with Gotama? If you say you become enlightened with Gotama, or that Gotama becomes enlightened with you, this is not Gotama's enlightenment. In other words, it's not us with the Buddha. That's too separate. It's not that we realize with. We realize as. The lord of the house is this I. It has this, the I, the me. It has nothing to do with skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, or anything to do with the four elements or five aggregates. Although the seasons change and the mountains, rivers, and great earth are different over time, we should realize that because this is the old fellow Gautama raising his eyebrows and blinking his eyes, all this is that body standing independently and openly within the myriad things. Therefore, practice fully. Clarify Gautama's enlightenment and your own as well. Let this truth flow forth from your own heart without borrowing the words of the former Buddhas or present ones. But this mountain monk would like to add just a few more humble words. Would you like to hear them? A splendid branch issues from the old plum tree. In time, obstructing thorns flourish everywhere. In time, over time, a splendid plum blossom opens. So simple. I and the great earth manifest the way right here and now. And then over time, the Yogacara school and the Madhyamaka school start to debate what is the truly Buddha's enlightenment. And then the Zen people get in there and the Rinzai and Soto schools start fighting. Thorns spreading everywhere on the old plum tree with this one simple, pure blossom.
Must have been some pretty great yogis alive around that
time. I think so, yeah.
I wonder if they would be friends with the Buddha.
They were. Yeah, well, there's many stories about that. Yeah, all the sutras are often about Buddha talking with other yogis and, you know, sort of like trying to discern how to practice together, and there are their different ways, and Buddha, before he was Buddha, learned many things from other yogis and then later taught other yogis. So it does seem like there was a special thing going on in the world a long time ago. In India at that time, there was like this yogic culture. Because it's just many people were just exploring mind and body. they had more time in those days. Yes.
Now there's the culture is just lots of Zen teachers. What I really was going to say is it's also kind of great in there that, you know, the I and the I people in English.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't think kids on the...
No, he wouldn't be.
Would have known that, you know, how that we would be discussing that English and that.
Yeah, it's a coincidental English homonym. The I, the true me I, is actually the I, the true Dharma I of Shakyamuni Buddha. And that we are all contained in the Buddha's eyeball. So, it seems like there used to be these yogis with a lot of time in India because things were so simple. So Kodo Suwaki has some advice to you who complain all the time that you haven't got any time. It's a good one for me. I feel pushed around by time a lot, actually. Really? It's already? Like days go by so quickly sometimes, and I'll think at the beginning of the day, these are the things I want to do today. I really, this will be. I have a vision. It's going to go just so wonderfully like this, and then things come up, and it's like over. Or I just, you know, get involved in the myriad things. I think without the internet, life would be different. That's a really big one. Really big one. I mean, because we've all had lives before the internet. Weren't they different? I mean, there were other busyness things too, but the internet, man. The world at our fingertips. Do you want to reach nirvana, to be liberated from your present life? It's exactly that attitude which is called samsara. Yeah, nirvana is like the freedom from samsara. You want to reach nirvana, to be liberated from what's this mundane existence right now? That attitude is called samsara. In other words, wanting to like somehow get rid of this. I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I haven't got any time. This is how some people go completely crazy. What should they do? The best thing would be nothing at all. They've just got to calm down. Not carrying out any human activity. That's zazen. Big businessmen and politicians complain that they're so busy, but at the same time they take their chances with two or three lovers. The question is simply, what is important to us? That's the thing, right? I got to do these things. Okay, this is really important. All the stuff that doesn't work out, and we get caught up in all kinds of stuff. But I appreciate that teaching of, if we want to see what our values are, if we want to see what's really important to us, just look at how we're using our time. We might say, well, actually, my values are really over here. This is what I would really like to be doing. But I hardly ever get to do it because I have to do this stuff. I think this is a deep teaching of actually our true values are shown to be this that we're doing because we're completely free. It's so hard to remember that. I'm not free because I have to do, I have these responsibilities. And we could say that's true, but the responsibilities then are our values. It's like we make the responsibilities, right? Nobody ever puts anything on us. it's so hard to accept sometimes, right? That we're completely responsible for this life. And I say, well, that's be, you know, I'm taking care, I'm responsible to take care of these people. But I'd really like to do this. Well, actually, that's great. Then this is our value, to take care of these people, which may be actually much better than what we think would be this other value here. But I think to see what we're actually, to say, this is really important to me, and I, therefore I'd like to do it, but I can't, I think it's not true, actually. Yeah.
The only thing is, sometimes we've got karma to work out or to pay back to society, and we're not totally as free as we'd like to be until we reach that point.
Well, like what?
Pardon?
Like what would be an example?
Well, the way I see it is that most people who have a lot of time for meditation and spiritual pursuits have worked out a lot of karma in the past that they owe to society, and they're more free from the society or the obligations to society, and they can follow their spiritual pursuits.
But like what would be an obligation to society?
I worked in society for 40 or 50 years, giving a service, that's the obligation. So whatever your service is, whatever you do for society.
But you didn't have to do that, right?
I did, because I had the karma to work out.
Well, you could say, yeah, wait. In that way, that gets back to this issue of free will, kind of like that. I think from that perspective, it's like it may be our karmic situation of cause and effect that we there's certain things that we're, because of our conditioning, that we have to do. But from, you know, at any moment there's a freedom within that to anything can happen, right? But there's a price to pay, right? Everything's cause and effect, so nothing comes for free. So if we're choosing to for example, not fulfill some obligation to society, then in some ways then we also don't get taken care of by society so much either, right? So that's a cause and effect thing. But some people are willing to just not be taken care of by society in order to be free from the obligation. But, you know, yeah, there's always an effect.
I think this is an issue that we all kind of find our way in and live with. And I really think at this point in my life that it is actually not, none of those divisions are true of this is my spiritual practice over here, and this is my obligation. Or, I'm going to do this so that I can get, and then this is my time. When I'm teaching at school, that's my obligation, but this is my time. Or when I'm caring for all of it, all of those divisions, at some point it became, no, that's actually not.
That's the best. When nothing feels like an obligation, right?
This is, you know, and I have one job in particular that was really difficult for me. And so I knew that I was going to change it, but I had a year, a second year to fulfill, and it was like, no, I am choosing to walk through this, right?
That's it, yeah.
Personally, and this is my spiritual practice, this is my life, this is my everything.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that's beautiful. Yeah, we break down the divisions of, as soon as we're saying, I'd rather do something else because that's my real value, then that's a delusion, right, actually. So, and then if we're complaining about the thing we're doing that I have to do, that's the delusion, right? So the way you're saying is, I think, even more true than the way I was talking about it, actually. Where it's like you find, you know, you come, you do what you feel is most in accord is more like, it doesn't matter so much exactly what you're doing. It's more the mind that's in accord with the way that you treat it all as practice. And then we're not complaining about, you know, we forget about this and then we complain. But when we're not complaining is when we're just like, it doesn't feel like an obligation. I think this thing of we don't really have obligation. We make our own obligations. I don't think society puts them on us. And when we call it an obligation, then we're trapped. I think then we suffer. But if it's like the thing that could have been an obligation, we turn and say, I choose to walk through this door. I choose to live this.
It might be more of a debt. You know, we're born to our mother and we're given things. And it might be more of a debt that we owe to society.
But we're making that a debt, right? We're calling it a debt.
Well, we made our karma in the past, sure. It's all linked up.
I'm just saying, because some people can say, like Shakyamuni Buddha, right? He's our guy today. he's our model. He was born as the inheritor of this throne, and his father said, made this huge effort. You really have to do this. It's your karmic inheritance. It's your duty and your job. You are the one to inherit this kingdom. And I've told you many times, I'm still afraid that you might not understand this. So I'm going to like not let you out of the palace even. And, you know, not going to see any other possible choices here. It was really, we could see, and he'd had a newborn child and a wife. When he was committed to, had all these commitments, and we might say obligations, and look what he did, right? It's like, if he's our model, did he like abandon his obligations to society? He left it all, right? And we could say, but it wasn't like a selfish thing. People like to say now and argue, that looks selfish to me. But we say, if it was really his bodhicitta, I'm doing this for my father, my newborn child, my wife, and all living beings throughout the entire universe. And you could say, we could say, in the realm of no independent self and no independent free will, you could say he didn't really choose to do that. His Buddha nature pushed him out the door. So, cause and effect, yeah. So if he had said, I really like to go leave home and be a Buddha now, but I have these obligations to society, we wouldn't be here now, right? So that's one side.
He was the monk who let the lioness eat him so that
yeah. Exactly. Yeah, he gave himself to others ceaselessly. And, you know, when people complain about this story and it seems like it wasn't being a very good husband and father, we know the rest of the story, right? He came back. He promised to come back, and he did come back. And his wife and son joined the Sangha and lived happily ever after. In a way, in an unexpected sort of way. So it looks like the net result was great benefit to everyone. And it might have gone differently. What if he had gone, if it hadn't gone that way? And he just ended up starving himself on the riverbank and died there. And no one, whatever happened to our Prince Siddhartha. Then we'd have a different story. We'd have a different story. The question is simply, what is important to us? To you, who would like more money, love, status, and fame, and everything else we might want, something we don't have, heaven and earth give. Air gives, water gives, plants give, animals give, humans give. All things give of themselves to each other. It's only within this reciprocal giving that we actually survive, regardless of whether we're thankful for it or not. That's a nice one. You know, we might, sashin, we might be like, I have this obligation to get through this sashin, and it's like, because I committed to doing it, and it's really not so great, and everybody's basically torturing me. Then we can like turn the whole thing and like, wow, everybody's like giving me this sashin. It's like not to the people sitting, but also the innumerable labors that brought us this food from the farmers and the, you know, truck drivers and the ones who built the trucks to deliver, and, you know, truly innumerable labors brought us this sashin and life. And it's just shift the perspective. Everything is being given to us, even when we're destitute and feel like nothing's working out. This moment of life is being given by all things. It's hard to turn it when we're weary and sick of trying. It's self-evident that a poor person suffers less from his poverty than someone who was rich until a moment ago. That's a great one, I think. It's self-evident, because it's so obvious, that a poor person suffers less from his poverty than someone who was rich until a moment ago. And if we have a lot and lose it, then we really suffer. But if we didn't have it in the first place, we may not so much. And, you know, I see this with some of my friends who, in the economic crash, lost a lot of money. And they were really, some people in it were really distraught. And like, I worked so my whole life for the savings. And I like lost almost all of it. And they're trying to practice with it too. And like, you know, I'm trying to see how to work with this. But like, it's really like every day I wake up when it was really just happening. Every day I wake up and like, I'm really upset day after day. And then I thought, that's so interesting, because like I have, you know, what they have now after they lost it is quite a bit more than what I have. But why is it that they're upset and I'm not? Because they lost so much. Yes.
This is directly connected to what we were just talking about with obligation, putting in your time. Because if I spent my life doing something with the spirit of, I'm not really wanting to do this, but I'm doing it for later. Even
yes, that's a good one.
I'm doing this so that I can put money away. Yep. Then yep. Your whole life is like
Yeah, and then if you lose it, then it's like I did it all for this thing that never happened. Whereas if you're doing it, it's just, you're doing what you love, and you know, support is coming because life, everything is giving to us. That's a beautiful perspective. Yeah, and like you say, in practice too, which Kodo Suwaki has been talking about, if we're practicing zazen to seek enlightenment in the future, and then we don't get it, sometimes we die too soon. Sometimes sashin, people have that experience in sashin, like I really had a strong goals for this sashin, and I failed. They didn't come true. And then we're disappointed only because we set up some future goal. That's why this zazen is good for nothing. It's so radical and so difficult. But then we have no problem when we don't get what we want because we didn't want something in the first place.
A person who even believes that they could attain enlightenment is insane.
Well, you're in the Kodo Suwaki school.
I am in this school.
It's, yeah. He said.
We do. Most people meditate for self-improvement, self-fulfillment, enlightenment. Call it what you will. And the science out there, the science associated with meditation shows that. It shows the expansion of consciousness. It shows improvement in all the mental faculties. It shows improvement in every part of the human person. And that is enlightenment. That's enlightenment. If you bring forth the potential within you, bring forth the inner life, experience it consciously, that all is enlightenment. And I meditate for that inner connection to the light, for enlightenment.
But you might not be of Curtis Rocky school.
No, I'm not.
What I'm talking about, because when he says, take a little sip, that's enough. You know, I mean, I think you said it's true. I think you said it's true that we know we get advantages from meditating. But I meant if someone is meditating with the idea of having an ultimate Satori enlightenment, Nirvana enlightenment, they're going to now know what the universe is.
But even for any benefit, I think, strictly speaking, Koda Suwaki would say, even if it's like going to balance out our emotional body and stuff, he would probably say, and it's true, he would probably not deny if you say, well, are those effects? He might say, yeah, there are, but we don't think about them when we practice. We just do the practice.
Not only do we get these benefits, but the whole world, as we read earlier, is benefiting from our experience here of opening up to the light.
And sometimes I'm in your school, and sometimes I'm in Koda Suwaki. I switch schools depending on my karma. he said earlier, it reminded me of this thing where he said, outside of a special group, saying something like, we must attain enlightenment, is just as strange as saying, we must behold God. You know, it's like this, you know, in the Zen group, maybe especially like a Rinzai Zen group, where there really are, we must attain this. It's like, it sounds insane. It sounds crazy.
It sounds insane.
Like, we got to behold God now.
Yeah.
Try harder to behold God.
We have to understand.
Oh. Yeah.
Let go.
Yeah, so there's these special groups that get into some weird stuff, right? Zen people. Everybody sleeps in the bed of Buddha nature and only dreams their illusion. It's a nice one. A little bit like the trains carrying you home already. Everybody sleeps at rest, at total ease in the bed of Buddha nature, and dreams their illusion. Not wanting a single thing is the greatest gift you can give to the universe. The world in which everything is given without having to ask for it offers a perspective which is cool and clear, wide and unlimited, completely different from the perspective in the world of every man for himself. They're so simple and true, right? But so easy to forget. To you, aiming at the ultimate way of life as taught in Zen, practice means the wholehearted inquiry, what can I do on the Buddha way here and now? So, like, here we are on the Buddha way. What can this body and mind offer to the Buddha way that I'm already on right now?
That is the expression of faith.
Yeah, that's the expression of faith, yeah. That we're on the Buddha way and what shall we do here on the way? Even with a cup of tea, it makes a great difference if you just let it slip out of your hand or if you put it back into place properly. So So even Kota Zawaki can talk about, in his sort of rough, no-nonsense style, even he can talk about the very wonderful Zen practice of careful attention to detail and taking care of. I think this is the same spirit of, we're on the Buddha way, so how should we manifest it right now with this teacup? Well, put down the teacup and get on with enlightenment? No. This is being Buddha on the Buddha way, how we put down the teacup, how we pick up the bowl, how we, you know, each, this is the beauty of Zen, I think.
Beauty.
Yeah, the beauty of it. It's beautiful when we give our body, speech and mind to the forms of practice in Sesshin. You know, outside of Sesshin in the world where people don't know that's what we're doing is also very beautiful, but Sesshin, we really notice, we have such a particular form, we can really get into those details, right? In all your actions, exercising them properly right to the end should be your basic attitude. If your mind is absent, even for an instant, you're dead. Strong words. Like if we're just like, oh, what's happening? There's a moment of like not being alive. Like, yeah, you could, yeah, that's true. That's true in a practical sense. Don't pay attention every moment or you get run over. Yep. What is the Buddha Dharma about? About being pulled by Buddha in all the aspects of daily life. Being pulled by Buddha in all aspects of daily life. So like, it's time to put the piece of paper down, like, should I just drop it? Or should I, no, like, let Buddha pull the paper down carefully. You should only go for the eternal way. Eternal way means continuous practice of that which is good for nothing. It's not enough to hit the mark only once. Having achieved 100% last year, or last period, or last minute, doesn't count for anything. You have to hit the mark right now. Don't waste your thoughts thinking about past and future. Be completely free in this single moment. Just eat the rice gruel. When you just do something, there are no people of higher or lower rank. There's no smart or stupid people. No delusion, no enlightenment. Just doing is the essence of the Buddha way. But it seems that it is exactly this just doing that no one in the world understands.
That's where you get just do it.
Just
on your shirt.
Just do it. Just do it. Anything anyone would like to bring up before the conclusion of this event?
I can't believe it. 13 out of 14.
And this afternoon, there's only 2 periods of Zazen. Those 4 afternoon periods seem to be the doozy.
I think it was 5.
It seems like 5.
I think it was 5.
50 minutes
each.
An hour.
Because I would think of a Rumi poem that Gabe heard me say one time. It's short, and it would express my feeling about the friendship that gets generated and the trust that gets generated when people do something like this together. It goes like this. I catch a falcon without a net. I release it to the sky, searching for God. This wine I drink today was never held in a clay jar. I love this life. Even as the great wind of leaving rises. Because there is a grainy taste that I prefer to every idea of heaven. This human friendship.
Thank you. There's a grainy taste I prefer to any idea of heaven. It's unique. It's special, but it's nothing special. One of the people who was here earlier in Sesshin, several people actually, sometimes people from outside of our usual Sangha who come in, several people have remarked to me, like, this is a really special Sangha here. This is like, this is an unusual, unique group of people doing this practice together, and it really touches people. So that's all of us. We make it with our quirky little selves, each one unique expression.
I think that's been my experience since I've lived in Santa Cruz. It's quirky, unique, and it's special.
Quirky, unique, and special. We should call it the Quirky, Unique, Special Zen Center.
Good marketing tool.
Quirky mountain. Weird temple. So sometimes too at this point in Sesshin it gets like, well, it's basically over now, so we're just biding our time. Some people I've heard say the last periods of Sesshin sometimes can be like excruciatingly painful because they're so excited for it to end, and they're just like, when is it gonna end? So we can check, we can watch ourselves. It's like there's no end, actually. It's just, you know, this is another period, and then that period ends, and we do some ceremonies, and then tomorrow morning there's some more, and it just keeps going. So it's not really that the end of Sesshin is so special.
System. We can ask ourselves in those periods, Buddha is pulling me through. How should I be sitting?
Yeah.
Is pulling me through these last two periods.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha nature.
Yep. Yeah, there's something like if we're already Buddha, then how should we manifest this Buddha, this period, and the rest of our life. May any heaps and piles and boundless, layers and layers of merit, jewels, gathered and accumulated without any intention to do so this week, be completely wrapped up into a beautifully woven bag and offered to all beings throughout the entire universe. flung open and spread everywhere so that every being is touched with ease and joy. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.